The Juneau Symphony is proud to present our annual Symphony Showcase, sponsored by Alaska Airlines and UAS. 25 of the Symphony's finest musicians will serenade you with their favorite chamber music by Rachmaninoff, Lowell Lieberman, J.S. Bach, and more. Performances will be Saturday, February 18th at 8 p.m. in the UAS Egan Library and Sunday, February 19th at 3 p.m. at Northern Light United Church. Tickets are available at the door. More information is on the web at junosymphony.org. We'll see you at the Symphony.
Across Southeast Alaska, Hope Community Resources partners with individuals, families, and communities to provide support that result in meaningful outcomes in the lives of people who experience intellectual and developmental disabilities. Call Hope today at 463-3602 or visit hopealaska.org and discover a world of possibilities. This message is brought to you by Hope Community Resources, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams.
Support comes from Southeast Living Magazine, Southeast Alaska's home, real estate, and lifestyle magazine, working to reach potential home buyers and featuring articles and tips on home improvement, available at various locations in Southeast.
You're listening to KTOO Juneau. It's 3 o'clock, and it's time for a Juneau afternoon. I'm Matt Miller, sitting in for the vacationing Jeff Brown. Rain in the forecast for the capital city today, with high temperature about 37 degrees. Some rain also expected for tonight. Coming up, we'll have a preview of a survey intended to help identify some of the needs of the homeless community in Juneau. Also, Theater in the Rough has a new production that opens this weekend. We'll also find out more about a unique conference on stewardship of the earth now underway in Juneau. That and much more, all coming up after this.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the National Indian Education Association met this week in the nation's capital to collaborate on how to fix the lingering problems with education in Indian country. Matt Laszlo reports.
The numbers for Native Americans and Alaska Native students are getting better, but nowhere near where educators want them. The latest data shows a 13% dropout rate, but also there have been some improvements in 8th grade reading and 12th grade math skills. But the numbers can be deceiving. Lily Eskelson, the vice president of the National Education Association, says as the Obama administration transitions away from No Child Left Behind and its standardized tests, it's vital to invest in new ways to assess students.
We don't want to go back to having no data. We want more. We want more data. We want better data. We want data that can be analyzed. Not, you didn't hit the cut score, so you get punished. You hit the cut score, so you get a prize. That's not what data was ever designed to mean.
Besides unreliable tests, tribal leaders also say they're struggling to maintain sovereignty over education in and around Indian country. And that includes passing on native languages. Quentin Romanos is president of the National Indian Education Association. He says it's vital for tribal governments to strengthen their relationships with federal and especially state education officials.
You know, 90 to 93% of our students are in public school. So the state controls the curriculum of those public schools. So it's very, very important that they have a working relationship.
There's also a funding problem. The president requested a $5 million increase this year to a program to advance Indian education, but the overall budget request for the Bureau of Indian Education is an increase just shy of $1 million, putting its total at $796 million. President Romanos says the federal government could do more.
And if you look at the total federal budget, the amount of money going to Indian education is very, very minute.
Educators say there's no silver bullet to fixing education in Indian country, but they say it was helpful to relay their concerns to lawmakers and staffers on Capitol Hill, who they report were eager to listen. Now tribal educators say it will be important to continue pressuring education officials for the reforms needed in Indian country. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
First Nations say there's still a big difference between reserve funding for child welfare and money for the rest of Canadian children. Several organizations were in court this week to try to force the government to increase money for reserves. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The Assembly of First Nations, along with child welfare advocates and the Canadian Human Rights Commission, have confronted the government over what they say is systematic and discriminatory underfunding for child welfare. Some Native leaders say the case could have broad implications for money for education, social services, and policing, and for the ability of First Nations to use the courts to claim respect for their basic human rights. They want legal affirmation that federal services provided to First Nations are comparable to those provided to all other Canadians. Cindy Blackstock is with the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society.
Because this is about children, especially, it should be decided on its facts and not some kind of legal loophole.
If the First Nations win, it means they could ask the courts to force Ottawa to match provincial funding not just for child welfare, but also for education, health, social services, and policing. If they lose, they might not be able to take full advantage of a recent law that gives them full access to the Human Rights Act. Many in the ruling Federal Conservative Party have fought First Nations' attempts to use it. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
On this day in 1863, Congress passed an act to abolish treaties made between the United States and Dakota bands living along the Mississippi River. The act was a response to uprisings between the bands and settlers. The act took away their lands in Minnesota. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use Pick, Click, Give when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're listening to Juno Afternoon here on KTOO, and I'm Matt Miller, and once again in for Jeff Brown this week. And with us in the studio is Kyle Rennick, Outreach Coordinator for the Glory Hole Shelter. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
And you're kind of a relatively new employee at the Glory Hole, is that right?
I am. My position began 3 weeks ago. I've been in Juneau for a few years, but this is a new position for me.
And what's the object, what's the purpose of your position? What are you supposed to be doing?
I'm going to be carrying out a fairly large research project here on Juneau's homeless community. It's going to be based on this idea of the Vulnerability Index Survey, and it's part of a nationwide campaign called 100,000 Homes. So this survey has been used by 113 other communities around the country. Anchorage completed their survey back in September, and we'll be using this to basically fill in some of the information gaps we have on our homeless population here in Juneau and find out who the most vulnerable are, what they're suffering from, and what they want and need.
Now, how are you going to go out and find some of these folks? I imagine you're not going to have a one place like the Homeless Connect event that was held recently, in which everybody's coming to Centennial Hall or another event, and they're all there, and you can count them and you can survey them. How are you going to find them in this particular instance?
Absolutely, Matt. We're going to be adding on to and filling in some of the spaces left by the Project Homeless Connect. That is really a fantastic event. They had 187 people show up. A lot of them got services, a lot of great information gathered. Really helps paint a picture. But the truth is there are also aspects of the Juneau homeless community, people who are living outside on the fringes of that, and oftentimes those are the most vulnerable people who have, let's say, physical or mental disabilities and weren't able to even find out about that event or to make it there transportation-wise. So what the Vulnerability Index Survey does is it tries to reach those on the edges, and we do that through something called the Registry Week, which is a week-long effort. Basically, volunteers group up in teams of four or five, and we'll go out to different different locations around Juneau. So we're talking downtown, Douglas, Thane, Lemon Creek in the valley. All around, we're going to send out teams and go to places where we believe people may be staying, spending the nights unsheltered. And so we'll actually take Project Homeless Connect out into the field. So it's an extension of the good work that's already been done there.
So it sounds like a lot of field work involved in this particular case.
Yeah, I'm going to be working on it full time and more than that for the next few weeks doing recon, finding out where we think people are. I've had the privilege of working with the Juneau Police Department already and some city officials, talking about where we know people are staying who don't have consistent homes. And so I'll be doing a lot of that research sort of on my own on foot over the next few weeks, getting out there and trying to connect with the people who are living out there. And then in the information gathering push that'll happen at the end of March, March 26th through 30th, when we do the registry week, that'll be a lot of man hours early in the morning to get out there and get as much data as possible.
Now, you handed me one of the surveys here. It kind of looks like a variety of different questions in regards to, you know, health issues that somebody may be dealing with, to, you know, how they find shelter outside of a shelter or particular home. Any other questions here that you asked the folks?
Well, actually, we are going to have five additional questions. This is a nationally created survey, but we're allowed to have five regional questions. So I'm working with members of the Juneau Homeless Coalition to come up with those. Probably will be a little bit more geographic based because Juneau is such a transitional town, being a regional hub and having so many services here. We have a lot of people passing through. So we're going to be looking for some information on, where people were 1 year ago or where people were born. So trying to find out about the flows and patterns that go on in our city as well, so we can use that to determine what kind of extended or coordinated services we should be working on.
Have you thought about a particular instance in which, you know, somebody may be a little bit reluctant to talk to you and they may not be wanting to provide such personal information for a stranger? Is there a kind of a strategy that you can work on?
I think that's absolutely a concern, and it's a valid one. You know, there before anybody is asked any questions, we'll have a little briefing, and there is a confidentiality and consent waiver. So all the information will be kept confidential and secure. But sure, there are, you know, I think a lot of these issues are very sensitive. I don't know if you would agree, but, you know, my health history is sensitive information. And so we're going to have hopefully a lot of compassionate service providers out there volunteering who understand these issues and can make people feel comfortable giving out such personal data. And I think basically the sense that we're going to be trying to convey is that this is being done in an effort to help Juneau's homeless community. This isn't a law enforcement effort. We're not probing into, you know, anything sort of shadowy or dark. We're just trying to find out who needs what help and in an effort to best provide that help.
And you mentioned the registry week, which is at the end of March. When will all this information be compiled and you start having a pretty good picture as far as what are some of the needs?
Well, you know, we're going to have In the week following the registry week, we'll have some of the raw data, and we'll be able to talk about that. It'll be our goal to have a press release pretty shortly after the event has gone on. And then after that, we'll be assessing the data probably for a few months. There's so much other information that we already have from Project Homeless Connect and other statewide gathered data that we will be, you know, it'll be my job to compile and sort of put it together in a few different forms. You know, one of just a huge book that, you know, we're going to be taking photos of people. We're going to be trying to catalog everyone so that we can use that in trying to connect people with services as they become available. And by the same token, we'll be creating smaller presentations so that I can, you know, come back out on the radio and talk to you for a few minutes about how it all went. So you can expect some data right away, and some of it, you know, talking to the people who did this work up in Anchorage, they're still working to sift through it. So some right away, some it'll be months.
Okay. Anything else we're missing here that you want to throw in?
No, I'd like to thank the people who've already made this happen as far as getting this position started and getting the ball rolling. That's most of the people on Juneau Homeless Coalition. I really appreciate all their hard work. And, you know, I'm going to have a call for volunteers pretty soon out here. We're going to look for about 40 people to come out and help us make a healthier community.
Okay. Well, Kyle Rennick, Outreach Coordinator of Glory Hole, thanks a lot for stopping by. And do come by again when you folks have more information or you start having you compile some of these results. Will you please?
Thanks a lot, Matt. Yeah, it'd be my pleasure.
That's John Barry's score to the 1968 film Lion in Winter, and it sounds like he did a little plagiarizing of some of his Goldfinger theme in that particular that particular score. With me in the studio is Aaron Elmore, Theater in the Rough. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Nice to see you again. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is the new stage and the proscenium in the new McPheeters Hall.
Correct.
I believe that was custom built for you folks, right?
Well, it was, actually. We had a chance to help design it and talk about the specifications. We worked with the architects and with the church council and the priests there and managed to come to a marvelous kind of compromise to create something that has been more or less in constant use ever since. It's great. There's been three full productions already. By April of this year, there'll be three more in the hall, so it's getting a lot of use. It's great.
And it's exactly how it was intended?
Well, it's a construction project. Nothing ever comes out exactly the way you want it. Of course, we always discover this critter's personalities as you go along and whether the light grid's going to fit and what the power is here and where this is going to wedge in this way. But it's come out exactly as we'd hoped. And our hope was that it would be usable and lovely and the right size for the room, and a good size for a wide number of Juno users, including us, obviously. There were a number of items that got done that we weren't sure about that have since proved to be fantastic. There are a number of things that didn't get done that we were like, oh, gosh, we really grieve that. But then now, having come to discover, if we'd have done that, we'd been missing out on this opportunity and this opportunity and this opportunity. So it seems to me, without trying to sound too ooey-gooey, that what we ended up with is fantastic, and what we didn't end up with, we don't miss at all.
Now, you have this is the fourth production in the new space, or is it third?
This would be our third. It's actually the fourth in the space, though, yeah.
And Lion in Winter.
The Lion in Winter, yes.
And this is not a Shakespeare production,
no.
But it's got a kind of a Shakespeare feel to it.
It's about kings and queens, so yeah. Broadly speaking, people walk in and feel like, oh, they're going to see people in some rich outfits, and they're going to hear some dreadful language spoken well, and that's certainly true of this. It was written by James Goldman back in the early 60s, and it had an interesting life. It opened on Broadway, of course, with Robert Preston, of all people, in the title role of Henry. And it was received well by some and not well by others, mixed reviews. A short time later, some years later, Goldman had a chance to revisit the script, and they made a movie out of it, a very famous movie with Katharine Hepburn and Peter O'Toole. And that movie gave legs to the stage play in a way that wasn't quite expected. According to Goldman, it has been more or less in constant production ever since.
Now, the production that you're doing, any similarities?
Well, we are doing, of course, what you can get rights to nowadays is actually just the stage play. There's no rights to the film script that I know of. The stage play is a little, it has more one-liners per square inch than the movie version does. It is a comedy, after all. It's a hilariously funny thing about some dreadful people treating each other very badly, but it's a lot of fun to watch. And obviously, design-wise, there's some big differences. When you do a movie, you have a chance to sort of slavishly try to recreate the costumes and go to these fantastic locations. And, of course, if you're doing a stage play, you have to scale all that back a little bit. You have to create outfits that you can use and evoke rather than describe the actual character itself. So the set's a unit set with platforms and some draperies and so forth, and the costumes have to be somewhat curbed in because we have to be able to move around in them comfortably and do all we do.
But the basic plot, it sounds like your typical dysfunctional holiday gathering.
It's absolutely your best typical dysfunctional holiday gathering with all the trimmings. It's a great way to put it.
Why'd you pick it?
Well, it's been on our list of plays to do. The role of Eleanor of Aquitaine is a fantastic part. Katie Jensen, my wife and co-artistic director, co-founder of Theater in the Rough, has had this role on her list for many, many years. And Eleanor's a monstrous, ferocious, fantastic sort of character who just cuts a swath through this whole family. And Henry's this fantastic foil for her. So for us, the two of us, to get to play opposite one another in these incredibly strong characters is a real treat for both of us. And we've also had a chance to incorporate some other performers that we've worked with for many, many years, and some with, of course, as we almost always do, some we've never worked with before, and that's been a lot of fun. Another first for us on this production, we're very fortunate to have Denise Gott direct this play. She's not had a chance to direct before, although we've worked with her as an actor 10 years now and more. This is the first play she had a chance to direct. She's done a fantastic job.
And I'm assuming you're playing the role of Henry.
Yes, I am.
So is it a little bit of unusual personal dynamic involved in the actual performance there?
Yeah, Katie and I are used to playing dreadful relationships on stage. It makes a nice counterfoil to the way we live our lives, which is really much, much calmer and nicer to one another than anybody we've ever played on stage before.
In any swordplay in this particular version?
There's a teeny tiny bit, yes, okay. As a matter of fact. We couldn't avoid that. But yeah, there's a moment when things get really bad at the very end. When you think your worst holiday gathering gone wrong, well, this one gets to that point too. So anyway, everything comes out okay in the end.
But we shouldn't expect a kind of an imitation of Peter O'Toole and Catherine Hepburn.
No. Yeah. I mean, obviously, that's one of the wonderful things about doing any play, and certainly about stepping into a big giant role like this that's been played by big giant performers like them. You have a chance to sort of, obviously their performances are in a lot of ways sort of soaked into our culture. We don't even remember not knowing what those characters were like. We don't think of them as those people playing those parts. We think of them as the actual historical figures in a lot of ways. We can't avoid that. Of course they weren't. They were just had words and they came up with these roles and they came up with their way of portraying it. And that, Katie and I and the other actors in the production, of course, have done the same thing with these creatures. We read the letters, read the words in interaction with one another. We find out who we think these people are by taking a little bit of history and a little bit of backstory and also mining the text and finding out, well, this reference here and, so I was this old when this happened and that kind of thing. Once you get all that sort of thing built in together, you sort of let it settle in your mind, forget about it, memorize your lines, and start talking to one another and see what happens. And that's the great exciting part.
Okay. And how long is this going to be running?
It'll run a month. We're going to start tomorrow night. We have a free preview this evening at 7:30 at the hall, in New McPheeters Hall at 4th and Gold downtown. We'll have an opening tomorrow night, the 17th, and we'll run also Saturday night this week. And then next weekend will be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night again. With a pay as you can on the Thursday night. And then the final two weekends, in the first weekend in March that begins on the 1st, will be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then the second weekend is March as well. The evening performance is always at 7:30. On Sundays, it's always a matinee at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
And the thing I should mention, we're getting a chance, very delighted to say that we're the Greater Sitka Arts Council is having us over to Sitka to do it on the 16th and 17th. So we're touring this over to the big wide water out there, and we're very thrilled.
Well, Aaron Elmore, thanks a lot for stopping by.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Abdel El Salami with Moi et Toi. That's off Putumayo's Arabic Groove album. It's being called a rare meeting, if not the first ever, of the three branches of Abraham in Alaska, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And representatives from the scientific and native communities will join church representatives for a three-day conference on environmental stewardship. Mary Walker is with the Fairbanks-based group Alaska Interfaith Power and Light. Reverend Kirk Carnes is with the Presbytery of the Yukon, which oversees 23 churches in Alaska.
It's called the One People, One Earth Climate Initiative, and it is bringing together climate scientists, Alaska Native elders, and interfaith leaders, including a Catholic priest, Protestant reverend, and Muslim imam. And so we're all going to be gathering. This is the event on Saturday, February 18th, and we're going to all share our perspectives on stewardship from the faith, moral, or from the faith, scientific and traditional knowledge. And they all look a little bit different, but in the end, you can see where we come together, and that is we must act on climate change because we have a moral obligation to care for one another and care for the earth. And so that's one of the things I want people to understand is when we talk about stewardship of creation, creation is both the natural and the human orders.
And Kirk Carnes, how did you get involved in this particular initiative?
Well, I got involved because my wife and I are very involved in earth care issues up in the Anchorage area. We've lived our whole lives in Alaska, but since we moved to Anchorage, we bought a bio-shelter home, which is a green-built home. It recycles water. It collects water. It does passive solar heat. It does a variety of things to try and live in the earth in a way that doesn't create such a huge human footprint upon it. So as a part of that then is also then getting involved in ways in my work to talk about the moral issue of the passion for earth care. And so that's how we got involved with this.
And your earlier comments, I was listening in between the lines, so to speak. It sounds like you're sort of implying that there's no disagreement among faiths as far as the potential for climate change and whether or not man may have an impact or an effect on it. Am I correct there?
Oh, yes, correct. I mean, we all understand. And I mean, it's science. I mean, that's what carbon dioxide is supposed to do. It's supposed to trap heat. And when we release as much as we do every year, that's what it's doing. It's doing its job. We're just releasing too much of it. I mean, any good thing in too much of it is not good. And so, I mean, a gallon of gas releases 20 pounds of carbon dioxide. I mean, just think about how much we all drive. So yes, we all have consensus between all the communities on climate change. But what we want people to understand is that when we talk about action, we're not saying that we need to do this simply for the trees or the frogs. We need to do this for one another. There are human lives at stake. And we know what to do. We've done it before. When we had acid rain and we were dealing with sulfur dioxide, too much sulfur dioxide, we got acid rain. We did something about it, and very successfully. We know what to do again.
Now, you mentioned your bio-shelter home. Some of the things that you do, is that something that kind of gets translated or become lessons in perhaps services?
Sure. But even more than that, as I'm speaking about earth care among the Christian folks that I work with, I happen to be a Protestant pastor, so that's in the interfaith community that's coming together for this event. I'm the Protestant pastor who's present. And so when I'm speaking to out of our own faith tradition, and I'm pointing out that according to the Bible, the purpose for humans were told in Genesis 2:15, God put the human creature into the earth and said, harvest your food from the earth and care for it. And that's pretty much the first commandment. Well, if we start talking about that kind of a relationship, if our role is to be caretakers of the environment, and we see that our environment is in distress, then that's a big deal. So exactly, you're exactly right. So if I'm speaking about it in one place like that, I need to also be putting my words into action. And one of the fun things about it is as we've been using it to invite people over, look at it, talk about it, people start telling us the stories of what they're doing. And it's really interesting that there's a whole variety of people in Alaska doing some fabulous stuff to live better with the planet, but we don't hear those stories very much, and we don't get encouraged by those stories very much. But that's the whole point.
Basic message here. I may be generalizing or making it too simplistic, but show as much compassion for the earth as we do for others. Is that basically the bottom line there?
Sure. Maybe a soundbite is the earth is our neighbor too.
In this conference, it kind mm-hmm. of pulls together people from all sorts of different faiths, also yeah. the scientific community mm-hmm. and indigenous leaders.
Yes,
tell
correct.
Me more about that.
Correct, yes. So, as I mentioned, we have Kirk Karnes, and then we have Father Thomas Weiss. We have Imam Chowdhury. Then we have Dr. Terry Chapin, Dr. Franz Muter, and Elder Elaine Abraham, Elder Rita Blumenstein, and Larry McCooliff. And so that's representing Yupik, Tlingit, and Aleut. And so those are all the folk coming together. And it's just giving the perspective of traditional knowledge, science, and moral. We want to inspire people to act, and we want to do this by fostering greater respect for one another. And we really want that to be the primary driver why people want to act is to care for one another. I'm constantly reminded of the Sermon on the Mount, and the one commandment Jesus gave us was to love one another, not blue people, purple people, yellow people, but all people. And in my opinion, one of the best ways we can care for one another, be it you live in Juneau or you live in Bangladesh, is to be good stewards of our environment, clean air, clean water, a bright future for our children. Who doesn't want those things? And so one of the points that I'd like to bring up about tomorrow, the Stewards of Creation Luncheon, this has been a vision of mine, a dream. I've been praying for this moment to happen for years.
And this is Friday.
This is Friday, correct. Okay. This is the Stewards of Creation Luncheon. And it's bringing together a Jewish rabbi, Muslim imam, Catholic priest, Protestant reverend under one roof to talk about one message, and that is stewardship of creation from the perspectives of the Torah, the Quran, and the Bible. So, however, there's another purpose behind this meeting, and that is to help us look beyond our differences. And if we begin to do that, to look beyond our differences, we will begin to see that what unites us as human beings is far greater than anything that divides us.
Mary Walker is with the Alaska Interfaith Power and Light, and Reverend Kirk Karnes is with the Presbytery of the Yukon. That interfaith conversation on stewardship and solidarity is tomorrow at Northern Light United Church, and that's from 11:30 until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And the climate conversation runs from 1 to 5 Saturday afternoon at the Egan Library on the UAS campus. Both events are free, and the public is encouraged to attend. Walker will return tomorrow on a Juneau afternoon along with Father Thomas Weiss of the St. Rose of Lima Church in Wrangell and the St. Catherine of Siena Church in Petersburg. They'll talk more about the conference during tomorrow's edition of A Juneau Afternoon.
Native Voice. And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 16th of February, 2012. It was on this day, 1978, the first public dial-up computerized bulletin board system, or CBBS, went online in Chicago. In 1978, the Internet was in its infancy, not available even to most computer users, but with the CBBS, members could dial in using a telephone modem and post notes to each other. It was the beginning of social networking. It's the birthday of the novelist Richard Ford, born Jackson, Mississippi, 1944, author of The Sports Writer, Independence Day, The Lay of the Land, a trilogy, three novels published about 10 years apart. He grew up across the street from the house where the novelist Eudora Welty had grown up. Richard Ford, who said, "For a writing life to flourish, your mind has to go outwards." It's the birthday of Henry Adams, born Boston, 1838, whose memoir, The Education of Henry Adams, came out the year he died in 1918. He was the great-grandson of John Adams, the grandson of John Quincy Adams, went to Harvard, traveled around Europe, journalist, later taught medieval history, also wrote two novels, a number of biographies, and The History of the United States of America, 1801 to 1817, in 9 volumes, a neglected masterpiece. Henry Adams felt that his education had failed to help him come to terms with a changing world, and that was the thrust of his memoir, which did not mention his wife Clover, who he was in love with and who committed suicide 13 years after their marriage. Here's a poem for today by Jack Riddle entitled Bus Driver. Standing at the back door, waiting while the bus's engine hums against the dark cold, its exhaust, a flume chilling into ice, melting the snow beneath it. Driver, hands in pockets, draws on his cigarette, exhales, and feels the mean language of age move in his bones. Behind him, in the loser's locker room, he knows his boys are dressing slowly, staring into mirrors, settling their wet hair straight, frowning at the way they have to look, trying to think of anything but the silent ride home. The snow, packed hard now in midwinter, squeaks underfoot, and the air freezes in the lungs, burns like a tongue stuck to a frozen lamppost. Driver glances at the bus, Wilson Public Schools in black letters along its side, then up into the sky, clouds crossing the full moon's light like angels trying to comfort anyone against a loss. The players come out, pass him, step up into the bus, find their seats. Coach gets on last, sits in front. Driver takes a last draw, feels the smoke mix in his lungs, exhales, drops the butt, a quiet hiss into the ice, gets on, and pulls the warm bus out across the empty lot, down a block, left onto the highway home. Bus Driver, a poem by Jack Riddle from his collection Losing Season, published by Cavan Carey Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry App, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Arts Up on K2 is supported in part by the Juno Artist Gallery, a cooperative featuring the work of over 25 local artists and artisans. The Juno Artist Gallery is open year-round, located downtown in the Senate Building.
And we'll have Arts Up coming up in just a few moments here on a Juno afternoon. Right now in the studio is Mark Fouette and Eric Goldsberry of the St. Baldrick's Foundation. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for coming by. And from what I recall, you folks have an event that's planned for next month. So I'm kind of curious why you folks are making the rounds.
Well, we have until St. Patrick's Day, until our actual fundraiser happens. But the cool thing about coming out to informing people about it now is this gives them time to set up teams for team fundraising for St. Baldrick's Foundation.
To grow out there here, is that basically it?
Yes, correct. It is, you know.
And for some little bit of background here, basically the idea is the St. Baldrick's Foundation is to raise money for cancer research. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes. 11 years ago, a group of individuals discovered that funding for different types of cancer research in America was chiefly based on adult cancers. And so they came up with their own foundation, the St. Baldrick's Foundation, to come up with the largest private source of funding for children's cancer research in America. So they took numbers that like prostate cancer, receives $293 annually in federal funding. Colorectal and breast cancer also receive numbers like $264 and $560 million annually for research. Childhood cancer was getting $192 million annually. So they took that and figured the bang for the buck for cancer research should be going more to children where their life expectancy is totally out front for them, where the funding for these adult cancers, you know, what is their life expectancy after cancer if they do survive the cancer? So they came up with this plan 11 years ago to shave heads and raise individual, you know, funds from everyone shaving their head. And that first event, they raised over $100,000, and they decided to make a go of this on an annual basis. And that's where we're at right now.
And the mechanism of how this works, basically somebody tries to raise money, pledges, I guess, in exchange for shaving their head. Is that basically it?
Correct, yep. You can get involved. You can go online to stbaldrick's.org and look for an event, which we have going on here in Juneau. You can sign up on there under, and we're having it at T.K. McGuire's Prospector Hotel this year.
Just right over here.
Correct. And you can get onto that event and sign up there. You can do it yourself. You can run together, get a team going together, you start doing your pledges and everything over line, online, Facebook. You can send out emails to people, and it's real simple. They can get online, and they can do it with a credit card online. Give a donation, and it's a secure site, very secure.
Any recollection of how much was raised last year?
We raised
Over $41,000.
Really?
Yes.
Correct. And that was just in Juneau here.
Every community in Juneau basically has one of these that has a substantial size fire department. Fire departments are really big into this event nationwide. Juneau last year did very well. In fact, we did better than Anchorage or Fairbanks.
And how is the St. Baldrick's Foundation different, or how does it operate differently from other organizations that may be trying to raise money for cancer research, like Komen for the Cure, which was in the news recently? Can you kind of differentiate between the two organizations?
Yes, thank you. St. Baldrick's is a volunteer organization. So everyone in Juneau who's working to make this event happen, this is just something we're doing because we want to do it. There are people who work for the foundation to assist people like myself and Mark to put on this event via email. And this coach helps us figure out the legal ways to do this, all the rules, you know, so that we don't get in trouble raising money because it is a nonprofit organization. But it is totally volunteer-driven on the local level, so much so that the financial amount for this charity, the overhead is very little. So nationwide last year, we raised $21.7 million was granted for research foundations around the nation and the world. But the overhead was 16%. When you compare that to other nonprofit fundraising charity events, 16% is very respectable.
And that goes for administrative routines and kind of maybe kind of little goodies like the hat you're wearing there that says, be brave, go bald.
No, this was a local vendor gave these to everyone who shaved their head last year, free of charge.
And you had, as mentioned, you had firefighters involved last year as well, right?
Correct.
Yes.
We have got, I'm going to throw it, we got a team from Reach. They've got an awesome site going there. They're hitting right there. We have Ok Bay Elementary School. The principal out there, she has signed up. She has got so much support behind her. And with her team that she's got going there, they're what are they at here? Just a second. They're at $1,300, you know, and it's still going up over that. And so this is a lady who's got a little over shoulder length hair, and that'll all be coming off.
And what happens to all the hair that's shaved off?
Well, for especially the people who have lots of hair, we can combine that with another charity, the Locks of Love. And they take a nice lock of 8 to 10 inches of your hair, and they shear that off together, and it's used for making wigs for ladies who desire to have a wig while they go through cancer treatment for them. But most of us, when we've got the short hair, it's just like a barbershop.
And once again, the big event is March 17th, is that right?
St. Patrick's Day, yes, sir.
Okay, and how do people get involved? How do they sign up?
They can go online, stbaldricks.org. They're more than welcome to, let's see, they can get a hold of me, Mark Fuette. I'm at the fire department downtown.
Mm-hmm. And myself, Eric Goldsberry. We both work for Capital City Fire and Rescue, and, you know, we're very easy to get a hold of, and just call the fire department, and we'll give them any assistance if they need it.
Okay. Anything else that we're missing?
My daughter's doing it. She's 9. She's got 10-plus inches, and she's excited. She's decided on her own to get her hair cut for Locks of Love.
And my son, Fu Bao, he's 12, and he's really having a good time doing this.
Mm-hmm. Mark Fuette and Eric Goldsberry, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you
for having us, man.
Very much.
Why I'm just a hairy guy. I'm hairy noon and night, hair that's a fright. I'm hairy high and low. Don't ask me why, don't know. It's not for lack of bread, like the grateful dead. Darling, gimme head with hair, long beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen. Gimme down to there, hair shoulder length and longer. Here, baby, there, mama, everywhere, daddy, daddy. A nest for birds, ain't no words for the beauty, the splendor, the wonder of my hair. Blow it, show it, long, it's nothing from my hair. I want it long, straight, curly, fuzzy, snaggy, shaggy, ratty, matty, oily, greasy, fleecy, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen, knotted, polka dotted, twisted, beaded, braided, powdered, flowered, and confetti, bangled, tangled, spangled, sing me in my toga, my toga made of blonde, brilliantine, biblical hair. My hair like Jesus wore it, hallelujah, I adore it, hallelujah, Mary loved her son. Why don't my mother love me? Hair, blow it, show it, long as God can grow my hair.
The original Broadway cast recording of the soundtrack to Hair from 1968, what we call in the radio business a musical cliche.
And with me in the studio is Nancy DeCherney of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Not a cliche herself.
You never know.
But in for Arts Up. And once again, there is probably a whole long list of events that are underway. We just had Aaron Elmore in a few minutes ago, and he was telling us about his new production. So that's probably at the top of the list there.
That starts tonight. He probably told you it opens tonight with a free preview. Its opening night is Friday. And, you know, it runs for a couple of weekends, but you always find yourself going at the last weekend, oh, dang it. So don't do that. Be sure to get in there to see that. Today is, of course, Elizabeth Petrovich Day at 5:30 today. The Cycle Alaska people are starting to do regular Third Thursday presentations about bicycling things, and they're having some folks talk about it sounded dangerous to me, so I don't want to know. Downhill car cross bicycling things over at Cycle Alaska, 5:30. You can go there. It's free. There's Sailor's Talk today, which is all about safety in the seas when you're sailing. That's at Northwind Architects at 6 o'clock. That also is free. There's a Raptor Center board meeting. Friday, Frostbite Music Festival starts up in Whitehorse in case you need to get out of town. That's something to do. All this weekend, we seem to have One People, One Earth, Stewards of Creation doing a variety of presentations and meetings. You can go onto our website to the calendar and look those up. Friday at 3 o'clock, Rasmussen Foundation, Diane Kaplan, will be here to talk about the Rasmussen's grant-making priorities for the coming year.
That's kind of important for artists and those trying to maybe get a little extra money to pay for supplies and other expenses.
Yeah, and it's good to know where they stand on these things. That's a free event, 3 o'clock. It's at the Jack, so come on down to that. Cam Burns is offering a photography workshop if you've always wanted to like hone your photography skills. 6 o'clock Friday night at the Douglas Methodist Church. You can call him 723-9496 to get more information. The Poetry Slam is moving all around town these days, and it is going to be at 6:30 at Thunder Mountain High School on Friday night. That's the Wushkinaday Poetry Slam. They have a lot of fun. They're a really exciting group of people, so be on the lookout for them. They may appear in a neighborhood near you. At 6:30 and 8 o'clock on Friday, it's the Fireside Lecture is about President Harding in Alaska.
Whoa, President Harding.
Yeah, that was back in the 20s, I believe. And then apparently there was some mysterious things that happened. So you can go and get the history on that and find out more. 7 o'clock, the Youth Exchange and Study Program folks are going to be, the students are going to be doing a public forum. This is moderated by David Noon at the Egan Lecture Hall on Friday night. Saturday, there's arts and crafts and collectibles all day at the Nugget Mall. There's various, let's see, that at the City Museum, a touch of texture 12x12 class for youths 8 to 16. You should call the museum to pre-register for that. And the annual Eagle Crest Fireworks Spectacular is at 4 o'clock, starts at 4 o'clock up at Eagle Crest. They'll have tram wreck playing and games and all sorts of stuff going on up there, and it concludes with the firework. Now, I would have to say this weekend, if you like to eat, this is your weekend.
I love to eat. That's my problem, though. I've eaten too much.
Well, it's a good thing Lent's coming, but prior to that, we have got, there's a fundraising dinner for Flip Floyd over at the Filipino Community Hall. That's $12, and you can get that one to go. That's at 4 o'clock on Saturday. At 5 o'clock, there is a wine, beer, and sake tasting for the Juno to Japan exchange group that's trying to raise money to get to Japan, bunch of students. And this is at the Hangar Ballroom. It's $30, and they have a silent auction with all sorts of really cool stuff, like car washes and all sorts of things that kids can do for you.
High school students serving up alcohol?
Yes. It's a new approach. No, this is to benefit these high school students going to Japan. And it's, like I said, that's at 4 o'clock you're doing Filipino food, then at 5 o'clock Japanese, and then at 6, let's at 5 o'clock, we have the Juno Black Awareness annual soul food dinner, which is amazing. So that's at the Tlingit Haida Center. It runs till about 8:30, I think, or until they run out of food. Tickets are available on our website or at Hearthside Books and online. I mean everything from greens and macaroni and cheese and peach cobbler and catfish and you name it. It's going to be fabulous. So you
get ready to eat this weekend. 6:30 p.m., the Friends of the Jensen Olson Arboretum are gathering at the KTOO conference room to get ready for summer, I guess, or spring. We have Roller Girls having a bout here. Centennial Hall, 7 p.m. Saturday night. Sold out, but they're going to try to have tickets at the door, so don't give up hope. Be there to sort of help our girls along there. Juno Symphony's...
Wait a second. Let me back up. Who are they playing? Who's the band?
UConn Roller Girls.
Oh.
It's their first international bout.
Oh.
Ooh. It's very fun.
Are you a roller skater yourself?
No. Back in the day, maybe, but never this kind. But, we happened to be able to catch their bout up in Anchorage, and it was quite fun. So, anyway, the Showcase Chamber is... concert, the Juno Symphony's annual showcase of their sort of ensembles made up of people in the Symphony Hall, are doing their, there's one at 8 o'clock and one at, I think it's 3 o'clock on Sunday. Always a real pleasant. The one, I think it's at the Egan Lecture Hall on Saturday. It's also Party Gras at the Rendezvous Bar at 9 o'clock on Saturday night. Faye Dudu and Rajan Cajun, there will be dance lessons. They encourage you to come in Mardi Gras costumes. It should be a big party at the Rendezvous at 9 o'clock. Sunday morning at 11:45, Juno Skating Club has their competition, and it's open to the public. It's over at the Treadwell Arena. You can get more information about that if you're interested. And we're having gospel music over at the Jack. I'll tell you what, I have been... privileged to be able to listen to a little bit of the rehearsals that have been going on, and they're going to need a new roof because they're going to raise this one. It's amazing. We have a performance at 2 o'clock and a performance at 5:30. I would really suggest that you don't miss this.
Both Sunday, right?
That's on Sunday, okay. Yep. And you can get tickets at the Jack online, Rainy Retreat, Hearthside Books, all the usual places. Then there's the showcase at 3 o'clock and dancing, international folk dancing at the Racquetball Club at 6 p.m. Monday is President's Day, so I believe that's a holiday for some people. And there will be a discussion of Northern Lights at the Marie Drake Planetarium at 6:30. That's a free event.
On Monday. Okay.
Also at 6:30 over at the Douglas Library, another free event, Writing at the Bottom of the Sea with Sneed B. Collard III. He is a children's writer, has won lots of awards, and he'll be here in town to talk about his research. He goes down in those submersible things or whatever. Very fun. Tuesday is Mardi Gras. And I would have to mention also along the food line, the Waffle House out in Auk Bay, all this week, this coming week, is having specials to fund scholarships for kids to go to camp. And so Mardi Gras is always about Fat Tuesday and pancakes and whatnot like that. So go have some waffles. Tuesday is parent-teacher conferences, so there's no school that day either. On noon on Wednesday, let's move right to Wednesday, the noon lecture over at the Alaska State Museum is Our Little Secret. One of the archivists is going to talk about all kinds of weird things he's learned from documents in the archives. Who knows what? The dirt.
Who's the archivist?
Larry Hibschman, I believe is his name. Also at 7 o'clock at the Egan Lecture Hall, it's the Wildlife Wednesday. It'll be Bears Eating Trees with Lori Craig. And Thursday, Sourdough Rendezvous starts up in Whitehorse. And at noon, they begin the Lenten luncheons at Northern Light Church. So that's it. That's kind of a...
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, but it should keep everyone busy and fairly well fed.
Yeah. I was just going to say, everybody's going to have a full tummy this weekend.
Yes.
Nancy DeCherney, thanks a lot for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy DeCherney of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. Coming up tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, host Pat Moore will find out about things happening at UAS. Also, we'll hear more from the folks participating in the One People, One Earth Conference. Also, more about that fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier and that show on the Northern Lights at the Marie Drake Planetarium. That's coming up, as well as Writer's Almanac, tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock here on KTOO Juno. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up in just a few moments. And first, local and state news update coming up in just about 30 minutes here on KTOO.